Come. Yes, Ensign Laren, please sit down.
Ensign Rowe, sir.
I beg your pardon.
The Bajoran custom has the family name first, the individual's name second. I am properly addressed as Ensign Rowe.
I'm sorry, I didn't know.
No, there's no reason you should. It's an old custom. Most Bajora these days accept the distortion of their names in order to assimilate. I do not.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge.
Oh, sorry, Cam, I just got here. Well, you might call me a late arrival. Sorry about that.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, well, this week we are here to talk about late arrivals in Star Trek.
Oh, wow, what a coincidence.
Tyler, what does that mean?
Well, okay, so look, we covered this a few weeks ago, or maybe a few months ago, with regards to, I guess, the opposite, with early departures. You know, characters
right.
that had left the series early, like Tasha Yar, Janice Rance, One Jadzia Dax, Kes, of course.
Vedic Brow.
The near and dear to my heart, Cam. Don't reopen those wounds, okay? And then pour salt in them. And then laugh. But what about kind of the opposite side of the spectrum, though? Is like the people that come in later on into this series. And like what we really want to do is examine how they change the course of the series to a certain degree, each
right.
consecutive series, because there's very obvious ones. But then you and I, we're also going to tackle some ones that don't seem so obvious. But we also have some very specific parameters for what counts
right.
as a late addition here. Do you want to explain just to the listeners about what, like who will count or what kind of character will count versus the ones that will not?
Okay, so the way we looked at this is, because we do tackle some recurring characters in this episode, not necessarily characters listed in the opening credits.
Yes.
Now, the idea is that these characters who we're going to tackle are characters who are introduced with a specific like purpose in how they were going to change the direction of the show.
Like almost shake things up, kind of like Cousin Oliver on The Brady Bunch, right?
Best example. Or Seven on Married with Children.
Or yeah. Chrissy on Growing Pains.
Who is Chrissy?
Remember they had a baby in like one season and like
right.
3 months later it was like a full grown child. That's 80 sitcoms for you guys.
Of course, of course. So, you know, like a character like Martok doesn't necessarily make the grade because he's not introduced with the intent purpose of changing the course of a character's direction.
Exactly. Like he was kind of a minor character to start
sure.
off with and then he kind of grew and grew over the course of the series.
Same though. Could be said of Damar.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and you know, if you're curious about our thoughts on Damar or Martok or what have you, we did do an episode about recurring characters on Star Trek.
Definitely.
I think sometime last summer, thereabouts.
Timing is meaningless to me at this point. I'm like the Founders. It's just like the beginning, the end. I can't tell which is which.
No, not the Founders.
The Wormhole aliens.
Yeah, the Prophets.
Yes, the Prophets.
Yeah, and yeah, time is not meaningless to you, Cam. Grammar, spelling, you know, articulating your thoughts, that's all meaningless.
Anyone
well.
Who's read the blog knows that already.
So, anyway, why don't we just jump into this? Because this is going to be a fun one, I think, here. And let's go with, I guess, the big kahuna from TOS.
Chekhov,
right?
Yeah, Chekhov is the first great example of this phenomenon. Chekhov was introduced sort of as a fix-it problem because George Takei was going to take a lot of season two off to shoot the Green Berets with John Wayne, which if the Duke calls, you accept the charges. The Green Berets, I gotta say,
I've accepted the
charges.
Have
you seen the Green Berets?
No.
It's insane.
Is it good? It looked kind of
No, it's
bad.
Not good. It's
okay.
not good at all. But it's like this very like pro-Vietnam War movie, but like they didn't shoot it in Vietnam. They shot it in, like, Montana or something.
Okay.
Or was it Missouri, I think? And so it does not look in any way like Vietnam. It does not resemble any sort of warfare that you saw, like, that we'd see in, like, documentary footage of Vietnam. And it just sort of ends with, like, John Wayne telling, like, a young Vietnamese boy, "We're doing this for you."
I'm sure that he takes
crazy.
So much solace in that after witnessing the atrocities committed against all his family.
Yeah, it's total like propaganda
of course.
Movie.
What but, was George Takei's role in that?
He was a member of like John Wayne's team.
Yeah,
you know, he went on some missions. It was not like a big showcase role, but he did have some dialogue.
His character purposely like? Was there a specific reason why they hired like an Asian American actor though?
Yeah.
Was he supposed to be Vietnamese?
Yeah.
See, and it's kind of that old Hollywood thing where it's
1968,
like...
1968, man.
Yeah, it's like...
maybe 67 when they shot that, yeah.
Yeah. But anyways.
Yeah.
So...
Enough about the Green Berets.
Yeah. We've got this George Takei issue going on. He's off filming, and it is cool that Takei's still showing up in season two, though.
Yeah.
But you want to bring in a bit of a young, hot... kind of stud.
So you call Walter Koenig.
You call Walter Koenig. You put him in a wig. Yeah. Literally, for those who don't know, I am not joking. Like, he's literally wearing kind of like a Davy Jones sort of monkey's wig because the executives wanted like this kind
sex
of
appeal.
Sex appeal on Star Trek in season two. So I guess, okay,
it's
viewers...
interesting. Well, I was going to say, it's interesting the story of like how he even got on the show. Because originally they had that role. They wanted a young Englishman. And then, like, how it wound up being a Russian is so confused because there was, like, a story that, like, and this story really got passed on over the years that they got a letter from a Russian viewer who was really angry at the show for not acknowledging the Russians. And they were like, okay, well, let's make this character Russian then. And then Walter Koenig was like, no, that's not true.
Really?
He said Russian viewers wouldn't have seen the show. They didn't show American TV shows in Russia
at that
time.
That's true.
And so he
was
said,
it a Russian American, perhaps?
Apparently that's not the story that got passed around.
Okay.
And Walter Koenig said it just wound up being that it was a tribute to the Russians being in space, you know, in the 60s.
I like that story better.
So, I mean, that makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
But it is funny that, like, this story became, like, apocryphal of, like, that's how it happened.
Apocryphal.
Yeah. Or, sorry, apocryphal, yeah.
Yeah. That's what I was saying, you know, how you're...
Yes.
Not big into the spelling. The
not
grammar,
at all.
You
know? Not at all.
Sorry. Am I being mean? Anyway, but let's talk a little bit about how maybe he influenced kind of the direction of the series, because it is interesting because I guess when you've got him as kind of comic relief, because I think for a lot of the time he does play that comic relief role, because honestly, I find it amusing whenever he does chime in like, well, in Russia,
right,
we actually invented sliced bread.
He was Gallagher before there was Gallagher.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I like Chekhov, but... Mm. I guess for, like, pop culture reasons, like, for the longest time, my first introduction to Chekhov that I was actually aware of was actually watching Star Trek Generations in 1994.
That's his proudest hour. He's so great in that movie.
I would have been 10 years old.
Yeah.
And I was kind of confused about who this gent was talking to Scotty and Kirk.
Right.
And why exactly were, McCoy and Spock nowhere to be found?
Mm-hmm.
But it was only going back and rewatching and really getting into the original series movies, not necessarily the show, that I was like, oh, this Chekhov guy is actually kind of like a significant part of the cast. Though.
Right.
But where do you think Chekhov plays is among all the main, quote unquote, main characters among TOS?
Well, it's such a tough question to answer in the sense that, like, if you're looking at season one TOS, I think, like, Sulu burns far brighter on the show.
He's got the naked now, right?
Yeah, then he
or the naked time.
Naked time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then he does later down the road. You know, once you bring in Chekhov, he kind of takes these showcase spots. So I think he really does stand out prominently on the show, but at the cost of maybe characters who would have been really cool to see develop more.
If you just had to, I don't know, go up to a stranger in the street and ask them... name as many characters as you can from the original series.
Yeah.
Do you think Chekhov would most likely not make the list over... Because I think you're going to get, like... Okay, obviously the Kirk, Spock, McCoy.
I think Uhura's going to get...
I think Uhura's going to get there. I think Scotty's going to get there. I think that Sulu's going to get there.
Yeah.
I think Chekhov might get left off that list more often than not.
I will say, as a very casual Star Trek watcher in my younger years, like, I'd seen the movies... And when I went to the original series, I was actually surprised how prominently Chekhov was featured, because that was a character who did not stick with me at all.
I know.
Other than the SETI Alpha eel in Star Trek II. Like, that was the only thing that really stuck in my mind. And so I was actually really surprised watching the show to see him featuring far more prominently in episodes than Sulu was at a certain point, and Uhura. And then also going back when we, you know, went and redid all the movies for our review, seeing how much like they actually gave Chekhov to do. It was like, okay. It's weird in that this character maybe doesn't like stand out on the screen as much as some of the other characters, but he's actually given a fair amount to do.
That was the biggest revelation for me, was when we did our rewatch of all the films, and I think the character out of, okay, you got the big triumvirate there, but then after that, the character that consistently had the most to do in every single one of those movies, it was Chekhov.
Which is weird, because like Scotty is such a big character on the show, and when you get to the movies, Scotty's often scuttled off to the side.
I don't know how to explain that. What is it about Walter Koenig that the writers are just drawn to, Cam?
Pure charisma.
It's that sex appeal that's...
It's still that sex appeal.
Okay. So let's briefly hypothesize this. What would happen if Chekhov was not introduced to the series? Where, like, I have to think, though, that the show itself would not have been changed all that dramatically, because it was always kind of the Kirk and then Spock and McCoy show.
Sure. I do have questions because, okay, when you add Chekhov, suddenly the show starts doing a lot of these kind of youthful romance elements. Like in, say, the episodes like The Apple.
Spectre of the Gun.
Sure, Spectre of the Gun, The Way to Eden. Do you think they would have used George Takei in those roles in 1967, 68?
I don't think so either. So. Yeah.
And so then I start to question, well, what would have happened there? Maybe in Way to Eden, it's like Bones's, you know, daughter, as they'd originally intended. But it, it does raise the question of, like, how many of these stories would have been really fundamentally rewritten? Like, I don't think it's a one-to-one. Like, if there's no Chekhov, Sulu's playing that exact role.
I agree.
I think it's probably going to be rejiggered.
I think, yeah, they probably would have just cut those storylines. But it seemed like the executives were intent on having some sort of younger, you know, gent on the series.
Definitely.
So if it would not have been Chekhov, I think it would have been somebody else. I think maybe then the real question is, like, how that would have changed the movies. And I think maybe in Star Trek IV, he figured much more into the plot. Remember when he got the injury and they had to go save them in the hospital? Featuring my most hated Star Trek music ever featured in the entire, 13 series franchise of films at this point?
Yeah.
Anyway. But beyond that, I mean, like I said, he had more to do than virtually all the other kind of secondary characters, but I think they could have, well, you know what? You brought it up. The SETI Alpha eels, though. I think that's actually a very significant plot point as well.
Definitely.
And he figured very prominently in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. So I think that would have had like big impacts if there was never kind of this Chekhov character.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It is interesting. There was a plan to bring Chekhov into TNG in season 7.
Really?
Yes. There was an episode concept, and this is Naren Shankar talked about it, where it was going to be him returning as a former prisoner of war, and it was sort of supposed to be like a kind of post-Vietnam parallel. And it would be him coming back to take part as an ambassador for negotiations with this planet that had held him. And throughout the course of the negotiations with this planet, it appears as though Chekhov is sabotaging them. It turns out he is plotting to use the Enterprise to lay waste to their capital for revenge and to screw things up for the Federation because he feels they abandoned him and let these people torture him. That would have very drastically rewritten the character of Chekhov.
So I'll tell you, I have issues with this premise in that, is this really a story that would give, I guess, the TNG cast much to do?
Well, let's compare it to the episode Relics.
Yeah.
Relics is very much like a bring back Scotty, shine the spotlight on him, give him his big moment. But you get, you know, Picard playing very, very important role. Who's the character they pair up in sort of a Chekhov story? Is it, again, Picard?
I my first instinct was Picard.
Yeah.
But I wonder if maybe they would circle around Worf to some degree. Like,
okay.
I think Worf might actually be, like, an interesting kind of character to bounce off of.
Sure.
Very much like how Geordi was with regards to Scotty in Relics. But the fundamental issue here is, like, in Relics, you get to see Scotty at his best.
Yeah.
With this premise, though, you're seeing Chekhov at his worst.
Yeah.
So this would not be a good episode to watch.
I think there's a reason it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, it would have been Walter Koenig's chance to have, a showcase role on TNG, which never happened. He never really got another showcase other than like showing up in like Generations.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, it's really then Uhura who is the only one that got really kind of I don't know, passed over amongst all the original series cast.
Which is so weird because she's basically among the most iconic.
I would say so, yeah. You know, I mean, she's the reason you got into fan dancing, Cam.
That's exactly why.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the next one, and that is Catherine Pulaski.
Yeah.
Fan favorite.
Fan favorite. This is a character. So there's two issues going on with me when I watch these season two episodes. One, it's season two.
Right.
Not great. And then two, you have a character introduced to be a kind of a curmudgeon-y character who is, I guess, diametrically opposed to a fan favorite, which is Data.
Yeah.
It's kind of a thankless role. Even though I think Pulaski has some great moments, she's kind of got the McCoy thing going on with her aversion to the transporter. Sure.
And that's where the whole her versus Data thing comes from.
Yeah.
Which, do you think it would have worked better if Pulaski is in season one and you have her kind of quarreling with Data right off the bat versus building Data up for a whole season and then introducing this character to pick on him?
You know, I think that's a very good point. Yeah. And the other problem is that she's kind of seen as like the replacement for Crusher.
Yeah.
Who is a very motherly figure, a very warm figure.
Yeah.
Which, you know, Pulaski is not. And so people are saying, well, I obviously like Crusher more than Pulaski. And Like I said, I feel bad for Diane Muldaur because, like, what can she really do with a role like this? Even though there's some cool moments. Like, I'm not saying it's like a character that had, you know, no, I guess, you know, value to the series. But what was your overall takeaway from an introduction, a late addition such as Pulaski?
The interesting thing about Pulaski to me is that I actually think this character works. Like, I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with the character of Pulaski. I think if you had brought her into a different show without the baggage of we've dismissed an actress from season one, I think she would probably work just fine. It's something about season two is so rocky.
Yeah.
I think it's easy to blame that character. Like, if people don't like season two, it's very easily to point to like a character who stands out and be like, that's, you know, part of the reason why is because you have Pulaski on that season.
What's your favorite episode from season two?
Measure of a Man.
Yeah.
That's my, easy.
I know. That's what my answer is. So then what's your second favorite episode? It must be Q-Who, right?
Yeah. I would say that, yeah.
Okay, then what's your third favorite episode? Are we just, like, scraping the bottom of the barrel at this point? What would you rather rewatch, season one or season two?
I
would probably rewatch season one.
Do you think season one? I might lean towards season two.
Okay.
Maybe. Ugh, that's so tough. Ah, season one is so brutal.
They're both pretty brutal.
Yeah. Season one is more of the campy episodes that I enjoy, like Haven and Justice. Yeah, so maybe I would lean more towards that one.
Is Up the Long Ladder your number three for season two?
You know what?
Two?
I am a fan of Up the Long Ladder. Well, I shouldn't say that. The first half of it. I think the first half of it is hilarious, and then the second half is like soul-crushingly boring.
Yeah.
So,
which is what the series is often guilty of in those early seasons.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, peak performance is pretty good.
Yeah, actually, I like
season
that one
too. So, you know, but you know, the Pulaski problem is like, I just don't think fans ever enjoyed this character, and that's kind of the problem. It was, I think, a very easy character to scapegoat, and it's funny, like, you know, in Memory Alpha they talk about how like at the end of season two, no one wanted this character back. Not the writing staff. Not even Diana Muldaur. It's like everyone was like, well, that's that, folks.
Yeah.
Curtain call.
Yeah. which is why I say it's kind of a thankless role. I feel bad for Diane Mulder, but
what did this character contribute to the show?
I did like her relationship with Picard.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
And look, maybe it's a thankless role to go up against Data, but I do like that she wasn't somebody who is completely enamored with Data like everyone else seems to be.
Sure.
So I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts, though?
I did kind of like, I agree with you about the Picard relationship. I like kind of the mature adult sort of relationship because
they seem more like equals, right?
Yeah, whereas Picard is usually held up higher than everyone else on the show. You know, it's kind of like the younger crew beneath him. You know, your Rikers and your Troys, they all kind of mingle together, but Picard always kind of stands outside of that. And I like the idea of this having this sort of more experienced, seasoned Starfleet member who can be kind of his confidant in a way that, and can kind of understand him in a way that maybe the others don't.
Is that why Rascals was one of your favorite episodes,
That is Cam? Exactly why.
Yeah. He gets to be on their level.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But yeah, so I mean, I enjoy that aspect, but I would like to imagine like an alternate reality. Like, how would fans have felt if you brought in this character in like season 3 when the show finds its legs? Like, do suddenly people have a warmer affection for this character?
You know what? I think the fact that if Michael Piller's like leading the writing staff, I think he would have had a better grasp of what to do with this character and make her more valuable to the viewing audience as well. So right. I think, you know, like, she came onto the series during a very tumultuous time.
Yeah, it was a terrible time for It was probably, was that the worst period for any Star Trek series?
Season 2?
Yeah.
I'd say so, yeah. Because you also had the writers.
In terms of just creative upheaval.
You had the writer's strike. You had so much writer's turnaround. It's awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So before we're going to jump over to maybe a couple other characters, and we should mention that one Miles O'Brien is not going to be included in our list here because, of course, he was featured in Encounter at Farpoint.
Right.
But this is not a character that I think that they introduced in the pilot episode as a guy that, oh, we're going big with. He's somebody who developed into something big.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a bit of a joke entry on my part. I didn't want to spoil it for you, Cam, before we started doing the podcast. But as a late addition, can we talk about Crusher?
Sure.
One Beverly Crusher.
Yeah.
She returns to the series, which is a very, very odd thing, even in like modern television, where like a character takes a one season hiatus and then just returns as if nothing really kind of happened. Which
right.
Do you think is a testament to, I guess, the fan outreach for the character, the presence of one Gates McFadden? What's your take on kind of the return of one Dr. Beverly Crusher?
I just always wondered if when it came to season 3 and they were trying to get this show back on track, they looked at season 1 and said, you know, like, the Doctor worked. Like, let's just get back to that because that was not one of the problems we had with the show.
Yeah.
Like, let's fasten down as many things that worked in season 1 and just try to correct the rest of it, because Gates McFadden and Dr. Crusher are nowhere in the, even, you know, the same galaxy of problems they had on that show.
No.
Like, she's working fine. So, like, why keep introducing more potential problems?
I'll just say this, though. I mean, I appreciate it more as you and I have gone to conventions over the year.
Yeah.
The years, but Gates McFadden is an incredibly thoughtful woman.
Yeah.
And so to see her return, it really is to the benefit of the series as
Definitely.
A whole. And having that character return, and honestly, it just makes sense if you have Wesley Crusher aboard the ship.
Yeah.
That, you know, as a minor,
right.
His mother would be there as well.
Yeah.
So let's be honest, the will they or won't they kind of aspect with Jean-Luc.
That's as pretty valuable to a show.
It is as frustrating as it could be for the viewers. I really love that dynamic that those two actors had.
No, very much so. Like, I think it's to the show's huge benefit that she came back.
Yeah. I just bring that up because that's a very unique situation that does not seem to be kind of a recurring theme within Star Trek.
And introduces even a little bit of continuity because they establish that she was away for the year.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of shows would have ignored it. It's just like, oh, hey, Crusher.
Just like, yeah, I was scrubbing the morgue the whole time in the shuttle bay. You know,
like. Yeah.
Anyway, so, Cam, why don't we jump over to, I think there's like two characters. Do we want to hit them like a kind of a 1-2 punch here? And I don't mean that literally, but just with regards to Guinan and Ro.
Right.
Because these are both characters. Let's start with Guinan, though, because season 2, another character introduced in the second season of Star Trek Next Generation, not unlike one Pulaski. This is a character, though, that I think that has a lot more going for her than one Catherine Pulaski, and her longevity within the series is actually quite the testament to that.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting with Guinan that they introduced this character, season 2, a season fraught with creative peril, and she seems really well-formed right out of the gate. And it's kind of the guy we all know and love, and it just works.
Does that speak to the pure talent that is one Whoopi Goldberg?
I do think so, because the thing is, Star Trek is filled with great actors, but Whoopi Goldberg is a movie star. There's a level of charisma that you bring to the table when you bring Whoopi Goldberg. Like, she kind of arrives fully formed in a lot of ways.
She is the center square, Cam.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Theodore Rex.
That's right. So, you know, I think, like, what made that character work so well is that even if the writers were like, you know, Whoopi, we're not really sure if this character is a little bit of this or a little bit of that, I think Whoopi Goldberg knows how to ground this character immediately.
So you and I discussed what would the series be like without, say, a Chekhov. I actually do think that a lack of Guinan in the rest of TNG's run would have actually affected it quite a bit.
Yeah.
In not necessarily the narrative arcs, but more the character moments we would have been deprived of. And you think of so many good things with Guinan in I-Borg, for example,
sure.
When
yeah.
she's dealing with her own issues with the Borg.
Yeah. Everything to do with Q. Her combating Q. Yeah.
Or just that relationship with Picard where it was always kind of mysterious, where you didn't quite know if they had like a previous sort of like romantic relationship, or if there's something particularly intimate about it that we never really saw with Picard otherwise.
Yeah.
That I just found very just intriguing and unique, and it brought so much life to Picard that I think like Patrick Stewart obviously really appreciated too.
Or even just look at a goofball scene, like the scene where I think it's in the Dauphin, where Wesley goes to Riker for and Guinan for romantic advice. And you just watch Whoopi Goldberg bounce off Jonathan Frakes. Like, just the amount of energy these two actors bring to this really goofy scene is so entertaining. I mean, imagine that with, like, worse actors. It would be brutal. It would be like, it would not make your list of your favorite kind of fun Star Trek moments.
So let's think about like bartenders from other TV series or films, Cam. Who would be like a bad replacement for a Guinan?
Well, you know, maybe the original intention for what Guinan would be, which was the most beautiful girl in all creation.
Okay.
Which,
like, they just wanted to hire like a California model.
I guess so.
Meh.
You know, boring. Which, yeah, it's like, well, okay, that's pretty unimaginative.
What would you think of, like, a Sam Malone kind of character?
Okay, so like a Ted Danson type?
Yeah.
So like a former spring ball player or something?
Spring ball.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Parcheesi squares.
Okay, well, actually, let's talk a little bit about a problem that Guinan does introduce to the series, which is that Guinan becomes, for a lot of the characters, kind of like a therapist.
Yeah.
Which is what
Deanna
Troi is there to be. And so you do kind of introduce this problem that in season one TNG, Deanna Troi, you can tell they're struggling with how to use this character. You introduce Guinan, played by a movie star. Suddenly that character becomes a lot more appealing to write scenes for, of her kind of talking characters through their problems. So
I know what you're saying on like an academic level.
Right.
But it just seemed as if they had two such distinct roles within their functions on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I never felt as if I was... Whenever I saw Guinan, like, guiding somebody,
mm-hmm.
I never felt as if that was a scene that Troi would have had otherwise. She seemed...
Is it kind of like the Chekhov taking romantic lead spots from Sulu?
Yeah, because
sort of idea.
Wasn't Troi so much more, like, clinical than Guinan was?
Yeah.
I think of an episode like... Oh, Cam, you're going to kill me for not being able to remember this episode title. What was the one where Loxana comes back and they do the mud baths with... Cost of living.
Yeah.
You see how clinical she is with regards to the advice she's giving to Worf and Alexander.
Right.
That's not something that Guinan would have ever
done. Yeah, like Guinan's sort of like the sage wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, of a beings that has lived for many, many eons.
But yeah. I do agree with you in that, like, it does affect... It does take up kind of one of the roles that Troi was at least supposed to have on this series. So no one's ever really... Out of all the conventions you and I have gone to, no one I've heard has asked Marina Sirtis, and we go to all of her panels because
sure.
she is always a hoot.
Yeah, yeah.
What she thought of the introduction of Guinan and what it meant for her character.
Yeah, that has never been brought up.
let's make a promise.
Introduce some awkwardness.
Well, you know what? Yeah. We do know that Marina Sirtis is very candid
during
these conventions, so I'm down to ask her. I'm sure she'll give us a a fun response, no matter what.
Yeah, I am curious, because I would imagine there was a certain amount of excitement among the crew just announcing that Whoopi Goldberg is on the show.
Yeah.
And not only is Whoopi Goldberg on the show, Whoopi Goldberg fought to get on the show. Like, she really wants to be there.
And it wasn't like she was in, like, 12 episodes. She was in, like, what, like, 70 or, like, some ridiculous number.
Yeah.
Like, it is, like... Okay, like she felt like the next closest thing to like a regular aboard the series.
You know, you have the Academy Award nominee for The Color Purple wanting to join your show. I think as an actor, you know, I think they were very aware the series was struggling in the season. So
I would hope they were aware.
So I would have to imagine there's a certain amount of hope, like this is really going to help kind of get this show onto the next level for all of us. It's going to mean further employment. You know, like there's good things that come to bringing A-class talent onto your show.
That's why you started the show with me, right?
No, Ben Young. so, you know, I have to wonder if there's a lot of excitement about that. But I wonder how much thought was going into story function.
I think this is 80s television.
Yeah.
At least when she was introduced. I don't think that was really...
It's something I think nowadays would be more of a concern.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if people talked about arcs and long-term goals for their characters as much in those days.
I mean, you had, like, Hill Street Blues.
Yeah.
Maybe Saint Elsewhere.
Yeah.
Otherwise, or I guess to a certain degree, Miami Vice. I think that was actually more episodic. I don't know. It was a different era of television, so yeah. I agree with you.
I think you wanted screen time, but I don't know that you had the expectations of like having your character developed more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why don't we jump over to Ensign Roe Laren? Because the...
I had one more note on Guinan. Sort of an interesting connection. There's a DS9 episode called Rivals.
Yeah.
With Chris Sarandon.
Not one of my favorite episodes.
That was supposed to be Guinan's son.
Okay.
Original script for Rivals. Chris Sarandon's character, who competes with Quark for, like, the better bar owner or whatever, was supposed to be Guinan's son.
Huh.
And Guinan was supposed to show up on the show, and she was unavailable, so they rewrote it. But he is the same alien type.
An Alarian.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just thought that was so weird, because I've seen that episode, Rivals, a few times. That would have never occurred to me had I not read that.
I have to be honest, I've only seen that one once.
Yeah.
And I know by the IMDb score, it is not a fan favorite.
No.
I need to go back and rewatch it.
Yeah. Because I remember... Watch it with that in mind.
Well, I remember watching the first time. I kind of liked it.
Yeah.
But seeing how much fans hate it, I do wonder if maybe a very young Tyler was just very... not great with judging things.
I watched it probably less than a year ago.
What'd you think?
It was not great.
Okay.
It's pretty forgettable.
Wow.
But yeah, they also considered her for the Voyager episodes 1159 and Timeless.
All right. I could have seen her working in both of those.
Yeah.
So you brought up Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
So why don't we bring up a character who is also supposed to be in one, Deep Space Nine. And that, of course, is the season 5 introduction of one Ensign Roe Laren. Again, I think this is kind of the epitome of the type of character that we're talking about here. We're like somebody who is planted within the series to serve like a very obvious function and influence and shake up the way that things are supposed to go. And obviously, I think everybody knows the story. Ensign Roe was supposed to be, you know, the first officer on Deep Space Nine. And Michelle Forbes, as magnetic as she was, as great as she was as a character, she just did not have any interest in continuing on with the Star Trek franchise beyond, you know, that her season 5. And I think she appeared in one episode of season 6. I think that was actually Rascals, which I alluded to earlier. And then she disappears in season 7.
And then shows up in
7.
Preemptive Strike in season 7. Yeah.
But I'll say this, Cam. Ensign Roe, the episode, that's a fantastic episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, where you don't exactly know what's going on, but you're in a very tough situation with the characters. And this is what I love most about Star Trek, is when they do this. When you give characters two decisions, a bad choice and a really bad choice.
Right.
And you kind of have
the Kobayashi Maru.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we got this with the introduction of Ensign Roe, and she was very much kind of diametrically opposed to kind of what we typically think of as a typical, you know, Starfleet officer.
Well, I love that, you know, doing research for this episode, I saw some quotes about this character, the creation of this character, and they said she was created for the purpose of creating, you know, tension and some conflict on the show. And it's like, what? On TNG, they were actually thinking about doing a character like this, like for that purpose? Because so often TNG is criticized by people who maybe aren't as big a fan of it for having characters that get along a little too well. And the mere fact they were looking to create a Starfleet character potential regular, maybe, or at least potential, you know, ongoing regular, recurring character.
Yeah, yeah.
Whose role is to mix things up? I mean, that's kind of shocking.
But don't you find
it seems very DS9-ish?
Don't you find it very fortuitous that they cast like the best actress possible for a role like this? In
yeah.
which, like, I think if they had given the role to another actress,
oh, it could be unbearable.
Well, yeah. At least just like fan reaction, like,
yeah,
because there's not like okay. So I'll tell you what. I was on one of the big Facebook groups and I had posted like a photo featuring both Riker and Shelby.
And, was it fan art?
Yeah, it's stick figures. And it's kind of embarrassing. I mean, more than one individual chime in, I hate Shelby.
Really?
I'm just like, really? Are you serious? You hate Shelby?
Yeah.
And, but like,
was it different attitudes at the time? Is Shelby a character who grows as society's progressed?
I guess if I think back to when I first watched Best of Both Worlds,
yeah.
then maybe I wasn't the biggest Shelby fan, but I go back and I rewatch these episodes now.
Mm-hmm.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is, like, I never hear any complaints on any of these FB groups about Ro. Like, I think just Michelle Forbes knocked it out of the ballpark.
Yeah.
They knew what they wanted to write for this character. It worked on every single level. When it's a character that potentially could just not work to on so many different degrees. But just think about an episode like Conundrum.
Right.
Where we have everybody lose their memories.
Yeah.
Just all the great moments between her and Riker.
That's an amazing episode.
It really is.
Yeah.
And just to flip everything on its head. And I'm just totally like, if I heard that there's going to be a Star Trek spinoff in like, starting midway through season 6 of Next Generation, and Ensign Ro was going to be a part of it, I'd mm-hmm. be like, hell yeah, sign me up. Like, I am down for this.
Right. No, I mean, I agree very much. Like, she really infuses that show with a lot of energy. And, you know, it's like, you know, the writer said, like, a lot of the times the TNG cast, you know, got along a little too well.
Sure.
It was kind of like, I think they compared it to like kind of like a fraternity, but in the good sense of like, it's all kind of like brothers and sisters working together. Whereas you throw a Ro in there who has, you know, her own baggage and her own, you know, aspirations. She's just like this human hand grenade to throw into these situations. It's suddenly like, she's not predictable. Like, you know, in a crisis scenario that a lot of the TNG cast characters are going to look at each other and you're going to kind of know what they're going to be thinking. Whereas like a Ro, you don't quite know because she is that unknown factor.
Yeah.
And I think she just works so well. Was there ever talk of her being a permanent character on TNG?
Not as far as I know.
Okay.
I think the idea was is eventually they would kind of get her going on DS9. And
right.
That never happened. So. Yeah. That's Hollywood for you.
Right.
But let's hypothesize, well, what would TNG have been like without Ro? And I think it's actually easy to look at season 6 and season 7
sure, yeah.
to figure it out. But I think you and I, we actually discussed this maybe a year ago or something like that about like what would be the argument for the best season of Star Trek, period, no mm-hmm. matter what the series. And I made a strong argument for season 5 of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Right.
And I think Ensign Ro plays a very big factor in that. And I think that season 5 would not have been nearly as strong as it was had it not been for that Ro factor that we got to witness for those 26 episodes.
And the thing is, you can tell with that character that the writers love her.
Yes.
You know, like Pulaski, well, we talked about Pulaski earlier. The writers obviously didn't like her that much.
Yeah.
And so, like, how invested were they in really writing A-grade material for Pulaski? Versus Ro, like, you can tell the writers like her a lot. Like, they're giving her, like, the next phase episode. Like, there's no reason, in a lot of ways, to give that episode to a recurring guest character.
I think a lot of it, though, is, like, she's offering something that they can't do with any of the other characters.
Yes.
And I think that's the key here. What do you think is your favorite Ensign Ro episode?
It might be Conundrum.
Yeah.
I think Conundrum and Next Phase are the two that jump to mind.
Okay. For me, and I don't want to say that she, you know, was a shining candle in the moment that she's first introduced, but I still think that Ensign Ro, the episode,
yeah,
was actually maybe her strongest outing, though. But
right.
All the moments, just from like a... moment number one to moment number 46, it was like the most consistent, strongest Row outing. But then we got so many great moments with her throughout the rest of season 5.
I think for me, I enjoy her just that little bit more when she gels with the cast.
Sure.
Like, she's a member of that crew, but she also kind of stands outside of it and is able to bring an energy that none of the others can. I think that's where I really like her a lot. Whereas Ensign Row, if I'm watching that episode first run, I'm like, maybe this character's never coming back. Like, who knows, right? This could just be a one-time deal like a Shelby.
Yeah, but you bring up an episode that, you know, like Conundrum, and where, she is kind of gelling with the cast, but it's also because of sci-fi and memory loss and all that. But it totally works, and I think a lot of it, I can't praise Michelle Forbes enough for that performance.
No.
So have we come to the end of TNG? Do you want to jump on over to Deep Space Nine? I think, is it any shock that we're going to talk about one Lieutenant Commander Worf jumping into the series? This is a very notable addition, late addition to Star Trek.
Is this the biggest one ever?
This has to be the biggest, most
attention-grabbing.
We could maybe in a few moments make an argument for another character.
Right.
But as far as up until this point in Star Trek, this was the biggest one.
In terms of grabbing fan attention, this feels pretty major.
Well, I just remember seeing photos of Michael Dorn on like Cinescape magazine. Sure. And, you know, like they were big into the return of Worf on Star Trek. And for, like a split second, this is like kind of pre-internet before I was really onto it. I thought he was just going to show up for like an episode or two. Right. And then when I slowly learned over the course of the summer, Worf is a main character on DS9. I was over the moon. I mean, like, this is one of my favorite, like, most iconic characters from Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because you go back and you watch Next Generation and Worf was a bit of a dunce.
Yeah.
You know, and what was it?
Worf was never like one of my favorites on TNG.
But it's so weird because he always was when I was watching TNG in first run. And it's so weird for me to go back and watch TNG now and compare it to what he had to do on DS9. I'm just like, why did I like him so much?
Yeah.
Like, do you think it's just because of his iconic look? Do you think it's the Dorn delivery? Or what do you think's going on
here?
Well,
I think Dorn is a big part of it. I think Dorn nails down how to play that character in a way that is very like attention grabbing, and he stands out in a scene. But I think also really what won people over a lot was his comedic moments.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the I am not a merry man. Like, they would give him those types of moments, and how do you not love that character?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it was because fans were like over the moon about episodes like Birthright or the Alexander stories, you know? Like,
what?
I don't think it was stuff like that.
Rightful heir? Rightful heir did not convince people?
I think it was just they loved how much fun this character could be. And I think maybe just the concept of, like, a Klingon warrior on the bridge was something that was very exciting.
Well, okay, so I think the writers and the producers would know intellectually that he was not the most dynamic character on Next Generation, but he was an iconic character. Why bring him aboard on Deep Space Nine then?
Well, I mean, I guess because Brent Spiner turned him down. I think it was actually, you know, I think he makes maybe the most sense to
bring
on.
No.
And they wanted to give kind of a shot in the arm to the franchise at that point, which is why they brought in the Klingons. That was never the plan. Why not Worf?
Yeah, and I think
maybe they realized there was a lot of unrealized potential with Worf. Like, is there that amount of unrealized potential for, like, Geordi? I don't know.
Probably not,
right? Whereas, Worf, there's a lot more to dig into.
Wouldn't you be intrigued to see Geordi on Deep Space Nine?
Well, is Geordi the second best choice? Like, say Michael Dorn was like, no way in hell, but they're like, we want a TNG cast member on the show. Is Geordi the next one that makes the most sense?
I've never really actually thought about that, and now that you like put that forward, I would say yes, he is, because it's more of that kind of outsider character. And I know people will be like, no, it's Data, but I don't know if we could have gone into more interesting depths with Data on DS9 versus what we saw in TNG, whereas I think we could have actually mined a lot more from Geordi if he was a regular on DS9, very much the same way that we witnessed with Worf, right?
Right.
So Let's talk a little bit, like, how did Worf influence Deep Space Nine? We have season four, and I guess half of season five, where it very much is that Klingon conflict going on. But beyond that, I'm not so hung up on the narrative aspect of it, but just, like, how much more depth we get into Worf's psyche, his character as a whole, how far more interesting and nuanced he becomes throughout the course of Deep Space Nine than he ever was on TNG. Yeah.
A lot of the inner torment stuff of Worf, you know, you saw a lot of him struggling with his honor on TNG. They would have a lot of episodes dedicated to that. But I never felt like I really, really understood the psychological, like, underpinnings of Worf like I did on DS9.
It's not one of my favorite episodes, but recall when Kern came back in Sons of Moog?
Yeah.
And
I just watched that episode like 2 days ago.
Oh, how does it play back to you? Like, it's been a little while since I've seen that. And like I said, it wasn't one of my favorite episodes, but it's still kind of a devastating episode just in retrospect for me.
It is, yeah. Tony Todd is really fantastic in that episode. Yeah.
And of course, for those who don't remember, this is where, like, Kern returns and he's kind of disgraced because of Worf's decisions, that the House of Moog is, well, once again disgraced.
Yeah.
And he eventually decides to get his memory wiped and get his ridges replaced with different ridges and join a different house. And it's kind of...
And it just leaves Worf alone. Even more alone.
Yes, and which is devastating for
the character.
I like
that he says, like, he was referred to as alone. I'm like, what about Alexander?
Oh, man.
They say, like, they have a line, I don't remember what it is, but he says something like he has no family or something, and I was like, oh, that's a little cold.
Wow. What about his brother played by Paul Sorvino? Biological brother, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, all that stuff is just like, nope, he's alone. I mean, I think DS9 understands the tragedy of Worf far better than, well, I don't know if TNG was the show to explore it. TNG was just a much more optimistic show, I think, than DS9.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the characters on DS9 are kind of alone, and it's about them kind of finding this community on Deep Space Nine, and I think Worf fits in well with that, but it definitely, I think, they had to kind of strip away a lot of the elements that the character had in his life from TNG.
How much do you think Michael Dorn appreciates what they were able to do? Because I get the sense that you go to these conventions, I think this is the 17th time I've brought up the conventions, you know, so far in this podcast, but he definitely had a lot more fun on the set of TNG, but as an actor, I would hope that I do get the sense that he appreciates how much more depth he had to work with as Worf on those four seasons of DS9.
I think he would realize it, because he would know, you know, he's the one reading his TNG scripts every week and going like, okay, you know, this is a good one, this is a bad one, whatever. But I think when he gets to DS9, he would realize, like, wow, my character is really getting to do things this character has never gotten to do. And I've played this character now for like 8 years, 9 years, you know.
Although it didn't start out well, because, okay, I think Way of the Warrior is one of the best, like, two-parter stories. But I think this following episode is Worf getting jealous of Odo being security chief on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Like, that was... And
that's definitely Dolt Worf.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Which is, like, the biggest fault that he had on Next Generation. And, like, Dorn's like, wait, what did I sign up for?
It's going to be, like, nothing but that for the entire series.
But then, look, I can't believe we haven't touched upon this. You hook him up with Terry Farrell, and we've got the Dax and Worf chemistry going on. And it's just... It was such a fantastic... It must be, like, one of my favorite character arcs of all time. I would not call Worf one of my favorite characters necessarily of all of Star Trek, but I would say that could be my one, if not my number one, but my number two or three character arc of all of Star Trek.
Yeah.
So, I think this was a pretty great late addition for Star Trek.
Yeah. Definitely. And I think probably worked out better than Geordi would have.
Yeah, but I still would have been intrigued by Geordi.
I would have been intrigued.
Would he have been undermining Chief O'Brien the whole time?
Probably.
What would Geordi have done week to week on DS9?
I don't know, because are you bringing him in as the chief engineer? Because you can't, because that really kicks O'Brien to the curb. Like, what is Geordi's role?
I think he retires from Starfleet and he opens up a shop on the promenade.
Mm, okay.
Jumbo sticks?
Yeah. Okay. So. Sure.
My best guess.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's move on to Ezri Dax, who, another late addition to DS9. And maybe one fans were less excited about than Worf.
Okay. Yes, I'll say this because I
think that's an easy one to say.
So I mentioned how, like, when Worf was coming on to DS9, like, the internet was not, like, fully a thing right by then. But with regards to Ezri, this was something that I was following online. And it wasn't, like, carved in stone that after Jadzia's death that we would get another Trill kind of character,
right,
a Dax symbiont coming onto the show to replace her. There's a lot of questions about, like, well, are they going to bump up one Andy Robinson? Would Garak become, like, a main character?
Sure.
Would you bring in some other sort of, you know, individual?
Yeah.
And I think early on the writers, though, were making it clear that they wanted another female star, because otherwise it's just going to be Colonel Kira and the boys.
Right.
So we bring in Ezri.
Like, why did we get rid of Zial? Wow.
Maybe it was just a changeling that perished in Sacrifice of Angels, and
sure,
they could bring back the original. Yeah. But in this situation, though, I think very much like the Pulaski situation, you're walking into kind of a thankless role. And
yeah,
I think Nicole DeBoer did everything she could. And I think I'm very much impressed with everything she was able to bring to this character in such a difficult, tough situation, in that she seems like such a distinct character. This is not a character like we've seen before in Star Trek. This is somebody who is incredibly green, somebody who's not ready to be a symbiont, and somebody who is even just as an ensign, not even maybe 100% ready to be like a Starfleet officer at this point.
Right.
And just to see her go through these big character issues in the first like 6-7 episodes, and then watch her kind of develop into somebody more confident, somebody who is more reassured about herself. And I think the very big turning point is where she and Worf kind of get together in the was it Penumbra? Is that the...
I can't recall.
Okay, but it's like...
I remember the episode you're talking about.
Yeah, and then they realize, well, you know what? We're all kind of hung up on our previous issues over this symbiont's marriage to you, Worf, and we need to move on. And I think that's really... There's an episode like Field of Fire where I think is like Ezri is a badass, but I think Penumbra is like one where like it's just Ezri as a well-defined character, a fully realized woman, and somebody that I can totally like follow her journey. And,
right,
and I had so many fears for this character when she was first introduced, but I'm curious about your perspective on this, just because you weren't following this in real time, that
you
watched the series years later. So what was your take on
I remember this? Having a lot of apprehension because Dax was really working like seasons 4, 5, 6, like it's like primed Jadzia Dax.
She's one of the best characters,
like
on the
she
show.
Takes a while to find her footing. Seasons 1 and 2 I think it's still a little bit bumpy.
Yeah, I agree.
But when you get to like 4, 5, 6, like you, like how do you not think Jadzia is one of the best characters on the show? And so when she got her very lame exit, I was definitely like, okay, like I knew Ezri was coming, and I'm like, I don't know how you possibly make up for that, the loss of Jadzia. I mean, I don't think you ever can make up for the loss of that character, but I think Ezri, I give the writers a lot of credit for, you know, Ezri's in one season, and it feels like you know that character really well.
I
like
agree.
When you look back on DS9, I often have to remind myself that that character only had, you know, her 26 episodes, because she feels like a very vital member of the cast.
But isn't the weird thing that, like, her weakest episode was Prodigal Daughter, which was, like, her one... Well, I guess, no, she had two showcase episodes.
Yeah.
She had Field of Fire and Prodigal Daughter, and Prodigal Daughter
was her CV pack and Parabellum.
Yeah. Like, that one was just kind of a dud.
Yeah.
But the fact is, like, yeah, she seemed like you knew the character, like you're saying, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something that... You realize that the writers at that point, they've been doing this for 6 years.
Yeah.
They kind of figured out how to develop a character fairly swiftly and make it somebody that you would want to be invested in.
Yeah.
Even though it's like a character that I think a lot of people could have issues with, just because it's...
Well, it's a replacement character, which often doesn't work.
It's A, a replacement character, and then it's B, it's much less of an active character. It's, it's more like stuff is happening to her. She is dealing with the new Dax symbiont. She's dealing with these new relationships aboard DS9, which she's not really accustomed to. So
she's doing this at a time which is all wrapped up in the Dominion War,
yeah,
which people are, you know, you really run the risk of a lot of viewers being like, I don't care. Get back to the Dominion War.
So, I mean,
the fact they pull it off is actually pretty admirable.
Hats off to the writers for being able to do this. So,
well, before we leave DS9, we should touch on another character, Vic Fontaine.
Okay, but why are we including Vic Fontaine but not a character like, say, Leeta?
We debated this back and forth because I think the thing was Leeta's introduced kind of as just like it seems like a very arbitrary girlfriend of Bashir. And then she gets some more episodes and then grows into a really important character. You could tell they liked the actress, Chase Masterson, but they didn't exactly have a rich character out of the gate. Whereas Vic Fontaine is fully formed, his role on the show is presented in a way it's like, how is this character just showing up now?
But you can kind of also tell that they introduce him very late in the run of the series, and they're like, "Look, if this works out, we're bringing him back again and again."
Right.
This also worked to the detriment, even though he was introduced in season 6 and Ezri was introduced in season 7.
Yeah.
But again, she's like the counselor character, and it's kind of like the characters are going to him for counseling lot of the time. Like, is that the same kind of Troy Guinan issue that we're dealing with here?
It is a little bit, yeah. But I mean, James Darren is so charismatic as this character, and this is a character that should drive me nuts. Because Star Trek's obsession with old-timey music is becoming like a parody at this point. And here's a character that is all representative of that. Like, why does anyone in this era, much less like the entire cast, are they so won over by this like Vegas, like 1960s lounge act?
So, Cam,
it's crazy.
When I was following the Star Trek news at the time and I heard about this character, I was like, oh, this series is just going downhill. What are they doing? Like, this sounds so stupid.
Like, I totally understand.
Yeah, but his way. That's a great episode.
Yeah, like, so that's like Vic Fontaine is a lot of fun.
Yeah, okay, so like you introduce him there, he's got one good episode, and then bring him back again and again. I'm just like, okay, I'm with the character.
Yeah.
Although, is this a good opportunity for me to share my Jimmy Darren story?
I think it is.
So
that's really why we're including this character in this episode.
I think this is my 24th mention of Star Trek conventions that you and I have gone to, Cam. And I recall, so what... What happened is they do the Rat Pack like every year, where it's like on the Sunday night after the convention is wrapped, they go at like a bunch of the actors, like one Max Grodinchek, Casey Biggs, Jeffrey Combs,
Armin Shimmerman if he's around.
If he's around, yeah.
And Ethan Phillips, yeah. You know,
they go and sing. They do lounge tunes. They're all Star Trek themed. Cam, that's like a good, what, hour and a half, 2 hours of just pure fun and enjoyment.
It's a blast.
It's one of my highlights every
single
year.
It's something that sounds like it should be really grating and awful, but it's actually not. It's really fun.
So a couple years ago, Jimmy Darren, he had gone to the convention. He was there for the... I'm cracking up just from calling the story. He's there for the Rat Pack, and he's performing. It's great. And so I go to the washroom. I wash my hands. There's no like paper towel or anything like that. So I just kind of got these wet hands that I'm trying to dry off on my pants. And I walk into the bathroom. And you're like, Tyler, I just shook Jimmy Darren's hand. It's like, oh, wow. Is he around? He's like, yeah, he's right there. Like, you should go up to him and say hello. It's like, I don't want to bother him. It's just kind of like, this is weird. I just washed my hands. It's just like... No, you're like, Tyler, you're going to regret it. It's like, oh, okay. I go walk over to him and I'm like, hello, Mr. Darren. And I shove my hand in his. And it's like, I don't want to speak ill of this guy who has to deal with so many fans all the time. But it's just like, I was like a piece of gum on his shoe, essentially. And like, just him like squeezing my wet hand. And it's just like, and this is a man who lives in Vegas. He had like those desert dry hands.
Right.
And I was just like, oh, this is the worst idea ever. And then like, I was just like, why did I do this? I wish I did not do this. And then I ridiculed you for like making me do it, Cam. And you were just chuckling the whole time. You thought it was hilarious. In retrospect, I can find it really funny. But at the time, I was just utterly humiliated, and it reaffirmed why I did not want to go and say hello to him in the first place.
I will say, I went up long before you did, and my meeting was very friendly. What? I mean, I was the first one to greet him after he got off stage, or you know, once he came out into the general area. So like, people formed after I had gone up and you know shook his hand, and I think that's when he began to get annoyed. And you were at the end of that.
You soured him.
Yeah, like I got him in his best spirits, and then by the time you got him, he was a broken man.
But the funny thing is about, what, like an hour or two later,
yeah,
we all ended up in kind of the what is it,
the deli yeah,
area,
sports deli
around the Rio Hotel in Las Vegas. And it was great because you and I, we hang out with like a group of people and we're all playing.
Not Jimmy Darren, though.
Not Jimmy Darren. But we're all at a table like eating pizza and like playing like charades on like, I think I had an app or something like that on my phone. And we're having fun doing that. And the next table over is like the whole Rat Pack, including Jimmy Darren.
Yeah.
And the reason I brought up my charades app was because I was like hoping that like maybe the Rat Pack would like come and join us. And,
spoiler, they didn't.
They didn't. I was just like, they're only one table away. But it was fun to watch them engage,
right,
so to speak. So anyways, that's our Jimmy Darren story for Fontaine. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on to 7 of 9.
Yeah.
7 of 9, big deal. We talked about her last week when we reviewed Scorpion.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, you know, her big debut. Now, you know, we talked in that episode just how there was quite a bit of controversy about the introduction of this character. Just when they were really advertising her in the silver suit and everything, like a lot of people were like, oh my God, it's like the Baywatch effect on Star Trek. This is beneath the franchise. Ultimately, 7 of 9 turns into a character that, in many ways, is the richest on the series, Voyager. I mean, you can make the argument for sure about for Janeway. I think Janeway's a great
character.
And the Doctor. But 7 of 9, I think, is the fan favorite in many ways.
Probably the most iconic on Voyager as well.
I think if you ask non-fans, they might 7 of 9 would be the one they might recognize from Voyager.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
So for me, though, again, this is when the internet is kind of, you know, going full throttle in the 1990s.
Yeah.
And we were hearing news about this 7 of 9 character. And when I heard, they want to introduce, like, a female former Borg drone in season 4, I was like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
That sounded really cool. And then, like, more news started to leak out, and we saw, like, the first, like, cast photos of 7 of 9.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'll be honest, like, I was a little unfair to the character in that, like, I was kind of offended that the writers thought that in order for me as an individual to be interested in Star Trek and to tune in, you needed, like, this very sexualized character to be on the series. And I was kind of offended. And then, like, I had kind of this pushback. It didn't help that a lot of the marketing for 7 of 9. Remember her first encounter with like Harry Kim?
Yeah.
She was just like, remove your clothing.
Right.
And I was like, really?
Yeah.
Like, and so it took me, it was not an immediate effect. It took me a while to get around 7 of 9 before I really started to appreciate her as like this very, very nuanced character, somebody who had so many little facets to explore throughout the series. And you got like weird episodes like Body and Soul, in which like, you know, the Doctor is his program is put into her implants, and he takes over her body every once in a while. But it just shows
that's a pretty fun episode.
It's a fun episode, but it showcases like what a great actress Jeri Ryan is, and you find like these kind of depths of humanity within 7 of 9 that just keep reappearing, populating the series like all throughout her run. I regret having such strong objections to her original appearance on the series.
Well, I think if you're, you know, a slightly cynical person, you look at 7 of 9 and be like, oh, I know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone is wrong for making that assumption back in the days when they were watching the show. I think if you were hardcore on board for Voyager from day one, you're hearing them cutting casts and bringing this character in, it would look like a very cynical studio move.
Yeah.
But I've always said, and I said on this podcast almost right from the beginning, or at least when I started talking about Voyager on the podcast, Jeri Ryan, I think, is one of the great unsung heroes of Star Trek.
Yeah.
In that she's a great actress, but she was dealing with like just baggage that no other actor, very few actors, had to deal with. Like, she was presented basically in an unwinnable scenario on this show, I guess in the same way Jolene Blaylock was too. But it's basically like, here's the sex appeal character. And, you know, she has to still fight to give a performance that wins over all the fans, but also makes her one of the most fascinating characters on the show.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, Brandon Braga, I don't know how much input he had on the ultimate design of the character on screen, but he obviously was greatly invested in writing for this character.
Yeah. That's one way to put it.
Sure.
I won't say anything more than that with regards to Brandon Braga and 7 of 9.
Right. But, you know, the sense is that regardless of what you may be referring to, the material was there for her to work with.
Yeah.
And to bring a lot to the table.
She is a very unique Star Trek character in that she is within that kind of archetypical outsider character that Star Trek loves to go to, but she seemed very distinct from, say, a Data character who is also kind of seeking out humanity, but it was more like humanity was being thrust upon Seven.
Yeah, which she didn't want it. Different she was thing. Very reluctant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but it's also kind of just like the unique backstory is like she was assimilated when she was like a kid.
Right.
And so like how do you go from kind of this adolescence human sort of state and discovering your adulthood is very much, and I really do appreciate the mother-daughter kind of, you know, parallels between Janeway and Seven, but it's very much that situation. And just like this was what a incredibly traumatic experience it must be to have been assimilated. It's like a kid.
Well, we see that episode where like all those people are being assimilated. It looks horrific.
Dark Frontier.
Yeah, that's nightmarish. I can't wait to talk about that two-parter.
So, you know, I'm all I can do is kind of sing the praises of what they were able to deliver with mm-hmm. Seven of Mine, despite a lot of the reservations I had going into season four about this character.
But a lot honestly, of the best episodes of the series are Seven of Nine stories.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, what's your favorite Seven of Nine episode?
Someone to Watch Over Me.
Okay, that's the one I was going to say.
Yeah.
Even though that's
it
kind
is sort of
a doctor
episode,
episode,
but it's big, you know, Seven of Nine moments.
It's one of Seven's like big showcase sort of, as you say, moments or episodes. So, yeah, that's my favorite as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, Cameron, so you might think, well, Star Trek Enterprise, who do we have to cover here?
Had Shran made it into season five?
That's possible.
Maybe we would have talked about Shran, but we aren't going to. You can find more about him in our episode, Best Recurring Characters.
Yeah.
But why don't we talk about the movies? I think a character that's really interesting to talk about is Savick. Because, you know, by the time Savick is introduced in Star Trek II, the original crew is pretty much carved in concrete, you know, like or in granite. Like, fans worship the original crew of the show. Well, hey, here's another Vulcan character. You know,
but I'll say this though, carbon and concrete. Although you know, one Leonard Nimoy was intent on leaving it, so
and you did have the introduction of Decker and Ilya as well in the previous movie.
Yeah.
So they were flirting with you know adding to the cast.
Yeah,
yeah.
So which I do appreciate, and it's kind of a bummer. Like you know, I as much as I like Robin Curtis, like I think that Kirstie Alley was the definitive Savick, at least in my brain.
Yeah.
And so, and then just hearing like Kirstie Alley a couple years ago at one of the Star Trek cons talk about how she wanted to return, and it's just kind of like getting like radio silence back from like the studio.
Yeah, it's weird because she had no sequel clause built into her contract, which nowadays would never happen. Oh boy, would she would have given her life away for that franchise. But yeah, in that point, she didn't. And when they wanted to renegotiate, she was, I guess, you know, felt she deserved her more money. I don't know what else she'd worked on at that point after Star Trek II. She may have done some things also that would have lifted her profile.
Yeah.
But when it came to renegotiating, it was just like, it just kind of petered out. And
but even Kirstie Alley admitted, like, during the filming of that film, she was a party girl.
Right.
And maybe not appreciating fully the opportunity she had been given.
How dare a 20-something-year-old in Hollywood be like that?
Wasn't she like 21 or
22? Yeah, she's pretty young.
She's really young. So I was like, okay, you know.
Yeah.
That said, I mean, it was amazing to see how well she gelled with everybody in the crew and just kind of the dynamic she had with both Kirk as well as Spock. And I think that the Kirk dynamic that those two shared, I mean, I think that was really kind of what a lot of people are drawn into. It was really good.
And the thing is, William Shatner is at his best, arguably, in Star Trek II.
Yeah.
And he's giving basically the best performance of his probably career as Kirk. I know you feel sometimes Star Trek III, right?
Yeah.
But like Star Trek II, I think, is considered
arguably
the best. And here you have, you know, this very young actress coming in, sharing scenes with him and holding her own. I think that is very impressive and a testament to how talented an actress Kirstie Alley was and what a find she was. It's interesting because originally they wanted Kim Cattrall. And I would have been curious just to see an alternate reality as to how good Kim Cattrall is at that point in time.
Or like if we wind back like 10 years before she got to play Valeris in Star Trek
VI. Yeah, like in 1982, how confident an actress is Kim Cattrall sharing these scenes that, opposite
that's tough to say
Shatner.
I did really like Valeris in Star Trek VI.
I thought you were going to say I really like Mannequin.
Sure. Actually, you know what? I did. I remember in the 80s, my sister and I rewatched that movie a lot.
And you sang the theme song a lot?
What was the theme song?
What was it? It was like, and we can build this dream together. Something, something, something. Nothing's going to stop us now, I think it was called.
I'm going to play that little musical melody.
Oh, that's our outro for this episode now. Yeah. But, you know, Kim Cattrall would obviously grow into a star, too. So it's interesting that both of the people that were up for it did go on to great things. Yeah, like, they obviously knew how to, like, Nicholas Meyer knew how to spot talent.
Yeah, Veronica's Closet, Cam.
Was she ever? Oh, yeah, Kirstie Alley. Yeah.
So why don't we let's stay with the movies. You know, let's jump over to, I think somebody like Carol Marcus, not in Star Trek 2.
Yeah.
I think she was introduced in Star Trek Into Darkness as somebody with potential to stick around and continue as a bit of a late addition. That didn't really happen. And how much do you think that has to do with the fan reception to Star Trek Into Darkness?
I think that's part of it. I know there was discussions about having that character come forward. And it was Justin Lin just said there was like, they just couldn't figure out how to do it. Like, how does this character even make sense? And like, would she be getting any screen time?
Well, it's kind of like, I wonder what she would have been up to in Star Trek Beyond. So the fact that they didn't wedge her in there, I'm actually kind of okay with that.
Like, what is her role?
My biggest fear is like her role would be to disrobe in front of Kirk for no reason.
I don't think
they
would have repeated that again after
the outrage
feedback they got after the first one. So. But I mean, you see in Star Trek Into Darkness, she announces, you know, she's like a weapons specialist or something. Or what does she say she is? She actually names her title and it's like a science officer.
Yeah.
And Spock is like, we already have a science officer. So it's like, you've just immediately said that this character isn't necessary. But I always think of weapon specialists because there's the scenes of her with all the missiles and stuff like that. But
I'm always confused because in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, like, she hated Starfleet.
Yeah.
It's
an alternate universe.
Well, but she made sure that... No, but, you know, okay, so, like, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan takes place about 15, 20 years after Into Darkness does. Yeah. So it's possible she learned what a horrible human being her father is.
Right.
And that's why she hates Starfleet.
Possibly.
And so she took off her Starfleet insignia and became a civilian scientist and taught her son
to hate Starfleet.
and
Captain Kirk.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. I mean, to me, I was always bummed out. I think Alice Eve was really good in this role.
Yeah,
I think
I agree.
This character had a lot of promise.
I agree.
And they just did not know what to do with her at all.
What was her most iconic moment when she ran away screaming from the transporter beam?
Sadly, I think I know what her most iconic moment
is.
And that's unfortunate for the character because I do think like Carol Marcus and Alice Eve could have been a really great addition to the film franchise. But I just don't think I think the writing was really poor in Into Darkness. And I don't think it's weird because I've always kind of gotten the sense, and I don't know if it's true, but it feels like Into Darkness was very much like an obligatory movie for a lot of the people involved. I mean, maybe not Roberto Orci, who poured all of his passions into that movie, but I feel like
as a 9/11 truther.
Yeah. I feel like J.J. Abrams and some of the others were just kind of like, yeah, it's another Star Trek movie.
I get that sense.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Whereas, like, when you get to Star Trek Beyond, which let's seg into now, and talk about J'la, but, like, that feels like something that the people behind it were really passionate about recapturing what Star Trek was all about.
And I think it was successful at doing that, but it just seemed like a less notable movie. But you and I, last week, we spent more time than ever speaking about one Commander Balthazar Edison, or Captain Balthazar Edison, a.k.a. Krall. But why don't we talk about, as you said, J'la in this situation? Because I think she was also introduced as a character that was supposed to be recurring. We don't quite know the fate of J'la in the future of the franchise, although with all the uncertainty going forward about this, I guess, Chris Pine Kelvinverse universe.
Yeah.
It's anyone's guess, but I definitely think that if they had the same kind of creative team behind it, that J'la would have been back for, I guess, the fourth entry in the Kelvinverse, because we did have Simon Pegg and Doug Jung writing another follow-up script for this, and I think J'la would have been there for sure. I think I was a much bigger fan of J'la than you were when we were introduced to her in Star Trek Beyond. And
I thought she was fine. Like, I enjoyed the character, but to me, she was not like a like the attention-grabbing character I think she was intended to be.
Sure.
Like the one you walk out just raving about. I never felt that way.
To me, we see like kind of the tragic departure of Anton Yelchin, and not to be, I guess, capricious about anything, but then I'm just kind of like, well, that kind of, it's a perfect way for Jayla to become integrated.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, just kind of take over Chekhov's place.
Right. Well, it feels like the most organic solution you could possibly come up with to a very sad problem. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would love to see Jayla return.
Yeah.
You know, I think she would actually fit in. She's better situated to fit into with the crew than, say, Carol Marcus at this point.
Yes. Well, I think with Jayla, you have a lot better chemistry with a lot of the cast than Carol Marcus got.
Yeah, I agree.
Carol Marcus had, you know, a couple scenes with Kirk that were kind of weird, and not a lot else. Like, you got to see her working with Bones a bit, but it wasn't like their dynamics between the two were really that entertaining. Yeah. It was more like plot function stuff.
Like, let me perform surgery on a torpedo.
Right. Whereas, like, with Jayla, you know, you get to see her building this friendship with Scotty. You get to see her playing off Kirk. Like, there's just more there, I think, to have fun with.
I think one of my favorite moments is when she calls him Montgomery Scotty.
Right.
You know, that was amusing.
Yeah. So do you think we will see more Jayla?
It's so tough because, like, we don't know really what's going to happen with this Tarantino pitch. I'm skeptical that's going to ever see the light of day, but then...
Or if it is, it's going to get dragged out for years to the point where there's no way in hell they're bringing the Kelvinverse back.
But I keep going back to the same issue again and again, in that we have a new CEO at Paramount who wants to make his mark. I think he's eager. He's looking at his roster at Paramount, and it's pretty slim pickings there. Star Trek is one of the few consistent franchises that they have in the stable.
Yeah.
It's still bizarre that they only put out like a Star Trek movie once every 4 years on average at this point still. But... So I'd hope that he'd push forward with another adventure in the Kelvinverse, because the Kelvinverse has been, you know, kind of a steady source of income from Paramount. So I would think they'd bring Jayla back. And honestly, if we do get the Tarantino pitch, I think there's a good chance Tarantino would want to work within the Kelvinverse, apply whatever his idea is onto this crew.
Right.
And I think he's one of those kind of geeky fans that is like, yeah, I like Jayla.
Yeah,
let's put her in the next movie.
When do you think the earliest this movie comes out is?
So this year is 2018.
Yeah,
and I'll give you a legit answer. I think by the fall of this year we'll know for sure whether or not this is going to move forward.
Right, because Tarantino will be doing a lot of press come July for his upcoming Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah,
and so you know that this is going to get asked to him a billion times. So I think we might start to hear something, but he's not a guy who jumps from project to project quickly.
Well, let's say he does. Let's say this hypothetically gets going.
Yeah.
I'd say filming a year from now and probably a release in early 2020 or late 2019. And I think that's being very generous, though.
Yeah.
I think that's so. At the earliest. But like Beyond came out in 2016. So it's going to be...
I'd say we're looking at minimum 4 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Tarantino is known for working slow.
Yeah.
So, like, it wouldn't even shock me if he's like, I'm going to take some time off. And we're looking at, like, early 2021 or something. Like, February 2021. In which case, it's like 5 years between Kelvinverse movies.
I know.
Like, to me, the Kelvinverse, which began with so much promise, is one of the great examples in modern sort of franchise history of just a franchise just being bungled, even though all the pieces are in place to make something really special.
I just think about like the energy that like just burst out in 2009.
Yeah.
And then just how it was kind of this stop and go, which is in direct opposition to what we see with Marvel, where it's just like, no, we kind of like, let's just keep moving the pieces along. We'll keep doing it. Even if you've got like a troubled situation like the Thor franchise, which you've got like, I think they left the second film and they're like, I don't know what to do with this franchise. We come back with Ragnarok.
Yeah.
I'm a far bigger fan of that movie than you are, Cam. But I think you would agree that that is really kind of...
Maybe, it rebounds from the Dark World.
It is. It does, really. But it's like, but either way, like you've got like this kind of like linear strategy within this franchise.
And consistency
of
output.
Yeah, and I don't see that at all with the Star Trek franchise. I think there's
I mean, I just worry that by the time you crank out part four of the Kelvinverse, to the audience, they're like, oh, these guys again? They're still making these? It feels old.
I'll pitch this. And everything's up in the air because we're also hearing rumors of CBS and Paramount merging once again after their split a couple years back. It's very possible that maybe the new Paramount CEO says, okay, let Tarantino figure out what he wants to do. Let's reboot Next Gen. And I think you and I discussed this a couple years ago about like the earliest we'd ever see like a Next Gen reboot. And you and I were thinking like maybe like mid-2020s.
Yeah.
I think it's very possible they may reboot the franchise much earlier than that just because they're just kind of like, I don't know, like spinning around and around and kind of like the drain just like waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
The good news here, though, the thing that I think is giving a little bit of energy is Patrick Stewart has said, I'd love to work with Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
That might, you know, give it a bit of adrenaline into the buttocks or something, you know, sure. Like an adrenaline shot there.
Maybe.
So, and you're right. I said adrenaline in the buttocks.
So do you think, getting back to Jayla, just briefly, just to tie up that character.
Wait, is that where we got here?
Yeah. Okay. Just to tie up Jayla. You know, do you think that we'll see Jayla again in some form? Like, do you think this character made enough of an impact that, say, Kelvinverse movie number four never happens or Tarantino does something completely different? Do you think Jayla's a character that has some sort of lingering impact that is revisited one day?
I would like to say yes, but I ultimately think no.
Yeah.
What were
to
you?
Me, the character is like Sofia Boutello is so good as this character. Like, she's what makes the character for me. That I don't know if I care enough if it was like, we're going to do it with someone else.
I don't know that
I would care. I'd just be like, I invent someone new. So, okay. Well, you know, before we just wrap up this discussion and move into a review of the latest IDW Discovery comic.
I'm sure everybody listening is just...
lean forward in expectation. Yeah. You know, Discovery is going into season two. There are going to be new characters.
Yeah.
You know, do you think... like, what kind of characters do you think they need to add to kind of shake the series up?
We need an alien. Like, we've got a lot of humans aboard our main cast. And I guess we had a Klingon in human disguise last season, too.
Sure.
But how they introduce that character, I would love to see my best hope is that we get, like, a female Andorian chief engineer.
That would be very cool.
I would be down for that.
Yeah.
You know, just somebody who I think is going to shake things up is going to be a different element that we haven't seen in Star Trek before. I don't think that's very likely, though. I think they want, if they were going to introduce a new character, it'd be just kind of something totally different that we would not expect. And the fact that you've got a fan, a geeky fan like me pitching a female Andorian chief engineer, I'm sure a lot of fans would be like, yeah, that sounds great, which means the writers won't do it.
Yeah.
Where do you come down, Cam?
I would kind of like to see an Andorian security chief.
Oh, okay.
I think that would be very cool. You know, we've seen...
Wait, you don't think Ash Tyler's going to come back?
No. I mean, I would like to see an Andorian security chief because, you know, I think back to the Andorian arc in Enterprise.
Yeah.
And how, you know, Andorians have that, like... combat mode, you know, they go into for like honor.
They've got ice picks, man.
Yeah, like the ice pick combat. Like, I would like to see Andorian combat worked into Star Trek. I think that would be really interesting to see. Like, they could work with a martial arts choreography, kind of develop a new style of how Andorians fight. To me, that's just a really cool opportunity for something visual and visceral. And Star Trek Discovery has shown a real talent for bringing kind of a heightened level of like fisticuffs to Star Trek. And I think it would be cool to see a more, kind of expansive look at how some of the other aliens would fight.
Yeah, my sense is that we're not going to get a character like Lieutenant Bryce or Reese or Arium or Detmer, like, bumped up to the main cast. I think they want to bring in, like, a completely, you know, quote-unquote alien element within the series, which I think is actually kind of a better idea. So I think we'll probably get expanded, you know, looks into those four bridge crew members that I just mentioned.
Right.
But I think going forward, Discovery, I guarantee at least one new addition to the cast.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a bit of a shakeup. I also suspect, you and I differ on this, I think Laurel might get a main cast
thing. I'm all for it.
I don't know how they're going to integrate her into the show week to week.
Yeah.
I suspect that one, Ash Tyler, will still be a main character next season. I don't know how they're going to integrate him to the show week to week, but that's just my gut instinct right now.
Okay. So let's just talk a little bit about the new IDW Chapter 3 of The Light of Kalish story arc. Tyler and I both reviewed issue 1. I reviewed issue 2 alone. And now I'm here to talk about issue 3. So far...
Alone, once again.
Yeah, alone. So we've kind of just been following the story of T'Kuvma, which is turning into a very simple story of a young
You're
guy...
You're making me really regret not picking up issues 2 and 3, Cam.
Who's sort of inspired by the Light of Kalis, goes and trains. And in this issue, we find out how his sister sort of betrayed his house... And
this is what I've been wondering ever since I saw the first episode of Star Trek Discovery, Cam.
Yes, and left him and his followers, basically the ship, the sarcophagus ship, and the freedom to just kind of go to space and leave the Klingon homeworld forever. Okay, here's what I'll say about this comic. This story is very simple. Like, it's weirdly simple in that I think they could have found a much richer approach to this story. I think it's fine. Like, here, I've read a lot of bad comics in my day. This is not a bad comic. It's fine. I think, you know, I can see why a lot of fans might enjoy it. They get something out of it. Like, it very much has prequelitis of, like, we need to explain everything. We need to explain, like, why he wears the armor he wears in the first episode of Star Trek Discovery.
Sure.
But that sort of stuff, it's like, well, okay, whatever, sure, it works. But I do think it maybe pinpoints a bit of a flaw in Star Trek Discovery in that they very much paint T'Kuvma in this story arc as this very sympathetic, noble, dignified character.
Yeah.
That is not what I got out of.
What are you getting out of this character here?
The character in the first two episodes of the Star Trek Discovery series, to me, was not the most sympathetic of characters. He was not a character I was actively, like, rooting for or found particularly deep.
Okay.
And I feel like the comic is much more presenting this very tormented character that I feel like more of an emotional connection with versus what I saw in the show. And so then I begin to wonder, like, you know, I know they talked a lot before Discovery aired about the Klingons are going to be just as sympathetic as, you know, the, you know, Federation characters. And I don't think they succeeded at that for most of it.
I agree, yeah.
And so it then leads me to wonder if, because Kirsten Beyer co-wrote this comic book, right? Like, it makes me wonder how much was sort of fumbled potential on the part of Discovery to really portray how, like, sympathetic T'Kuvma's plight should be to the audience.
Yeah.
I don't know. But there was an interesting side note I was, you know, with this comic. And, you know, the arc wraps up on the next issue. So I'm looking forward to kind of looking at the whole thing and seeing if this was really worth the investment and maybe what the comic should do going forward. But I was just kind of flipping through it. The back of this comic, there's an interview with Kirsten Beyer, which I decided to read to see if there's any nuggets that were interesting.
You wanted to see if she name-dropped subspace transmissions in the interview.
Spoiler, she did not. But at the near the end of the interview, they're saying, you know, like, what should fans look forward to from Star Trek Discovery? And she says, look forward to my episode. It's coming out November 5th.
Is that CV Packham Parabellum?
That is exactly what episode. And then I paused. I'm like, when was this this interview conducted?
Yeah.
Because this, you know, issue just came out in March. So I flip to the front of the comic, and I look at the publication date, and it says December 2017.
Okay. Which would have been after she had done that interview anyway.
Which, sure, well, sure.
Or after the CV Packham Parabellum even aired. Okay.
But I know sometimes comics are delayed for whatever reason before they, you know, hit stands. That happens a lot. But this is quite delayed. Like, this is 3 months. And I commented last time when I reviewed issue number 2 that this story feels like this whole arc feels like it's coming well past its relevancy date.
Oh yeah.
And so then I'm like, well, was this arc meant to wrap up in like January,
like before we came back from the extended break?
Yeah, like originally was that the intention?
So what do you think the issue is? Like, do you think it's
maybe just the publishing schedule of the company,
which happens.
Which it happens a lot. I remember collecting comics more vigorously, and you would see sometimes the dates didn't line up with when they came out.
When did we pick up our issue number ones from the comic book store, Kim?
I think it may have been late November.
Yeah. So then that actually makes sense that I think just everything got delayed.
Yeah.
So.
So I think.
But why would they not just follow up with a quick phone call to Kirsten Beyer for an updated interview?
I don't know.
Because that's kind of embarrassing that this March publication.
Yeah.
It literally has her saying, "Watch my episode in November."
Yeah.
And honestly, it was not a well-reviewed episode, at least on this
show. No. But I will say I am looking forward to IDW's supersized special that's coming up on Stamets. I'm looking forward to like a standalone extended story that's not dependent on me tuning in every like month and a half.
It's not going to be like four razor-thin issues where you flip through them and after eight pages you have to tune in like 6 weeks later. It's going to be kind of like a much more longer form like graphic comic.
Correct, yeah.
I might pick that one up.
Yeah, to me that's more interesting, and I think maybe points the way to maybe the way to go with these. Because if they are going to have issues that are delayed, it's not a smart idea to be cranking out four issue stories on peripheral characters that are phased out or early in the season's run. It just doesn't really, like, who's gonna be grabbing an issue in April or whatever, early May or whatever, to find the conclusion to the Takuvmar other than me?
Yeah. I think you are single-handedly pumping up this entire IDW comic series, Cam.
Well, it's my role to play.
Yeah.
Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Speaking of Discovery, you can still go there and find the link to our rankings of each episode of Discovery.
Yeah, that was fun, Cam.
Yeah, see where we differ, where we align. You know, there's some interesting discussion to be had. And
Like there are some interesting similarities, which maybe a lot of people wouldn't be surprised by, but there are some like very notable divergences as well. So,
Shailene Woodley.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you, Cam.
Okay, so Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Okay, so we're going to tackle kind of evolution of Star Trek, but we're going to go series by series. And as we were kind of alluding to in this episode, Cam, there are points within the run of a series where they fundamentally change. These are what we're calling Star Trek, you know, turning points or transition points. So what was it? What was it, season three of Next Gen for you? Is that when the series really came into its own? For me, maybe it was Enterprise. At a certain point, I was like, oh, this is where the series became one thing from what it was originally, and this is where we really get engaged. So we're going to be tackling, you know, kind of the big notable transition points in the evolution of Star Trek series and really what it means for the franchise, I think, both in terms of character as well as storytelling.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vic Fontaine Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Naomi Wildman. That would have been a great late addition if we actually tackle it, Cam.
For part two.
Part two.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.